This week on Off Topic, Death in the Digital Age. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
We talk about video games and the digital logic of death with Steve Pusday.
What happens when we begin to break down death and begin to think about it in new ways and structure it in new ways?
We talked to poet Jane Hilberry about poetic imaginings of death.
I think poetry has helped me think about mortality, and I think the reason I started writing poetry was because I had a sister who died when I was very young. I was 3 years old.
And we remember Lego Universe.
It could be like, you know, hockey, how it goes on strike for such a long time, and then all of a sudden you're like, bring it back, and then it's back.
Stay with us. I'm Steve Hayward, and you're listening to Off Topic. Today we're talking about death in the digital age. Though lovers be lost, love shall not, and death shall have no dominion. That's from a famous poem by Dylan Thomas, who wrote that near the beginning of the 20th century, about halfway through. And way back then, in those old days that were the 20th century, death meant something final. That undiscovered country from which no one returned. But today, we talk about dying all the time. Our hard drives die on a regular basis. If we drop our cell phones into the bathtub, they die a watery death. And anybody who's ever played any video games is accustomed to dying all the time. Today, we ask, what does it all mean? What is death in the digital age? Does it change the way we think about the death of ourselves and others? Or is death the one thing that the digital age can't change? Halfway through his 40s, Professor Stillman had, without quite meaning to, become the sort of person for whom venturing out after 8 p.m. was a risky, troubling event. Once in college, before he was married, he'd laid out all night on the hood of a car with a girl named Christy. She was now an ophthalmologist. And now, when his wife told him, over dinner, that they needed milk, a ripple of pure panic coursed down his spine. He knew he had no choice. He would have to go out and get milk. To get to the store, Professor Stillman had to drive through campus, past his office, and as he did, he remembered that he'd forgot his copy of Shakespeare's King Lear. He was teaching the play the following morning, and he knew he should probably look at it again. Conveying to undergraduates the tragic depth of the play was something Stillman did, or tried to do, each March, with varying degrees of success. Particularly that last scene, when Lear kneels before his youngest daughter, Cordelia. "Can you imagine your parents kneeling before you?" he'd asked his class last year, and there had been no response. He then made an attempt to put it in contemporary terms. "Imagine," he said, "imagine you paying your parents' cell phone bill." The gasps were audible. "I get it," said a boy in the front row. "It's like Lear's cell phone's been cut off, and Cordelia, this kid of his, comes in and gets him a new contract and a new phone and everything." "Precisely," said Stillman, "only more so." A number of students wrote that down. Stillman swore that he would never teach the play again. But now, here he was. Leaving his office, he tucked the worn paperback under his arm and was stepping out into the parking lot when he encountered a student of his named Henry, who was in his Shakespeare class. "Professor Stillman," said Henry, recognizing him. 6'2", captain of the ultimate frisbee team, Henry was dressed in what appeared to be an ancient gray wedding dress, rubber flippers, massive plastic purple eyeglasses, and a tall, multicolored afro wig. Seeing Professor Stillman's expression, Henry explained. "We're all dressed up," he said. "We're doing a Harlem shake in the library." Stillman nodded and pretended to know what was being talked about. "It's this thing on the internet," said Henry. "A Harlem shake." Stillman said it sounded quite unconventional. It is, said Henry. It's like completely and totally quite unconventional. Henry's companion, a boy who had on a giant Mickey Mouse head, said, you should come. Yeah, Henry told him, you should totally come. Okay, said Stillman, I'll come. Seriously, said Henry. Stillman looked at his copy of King Lear. Yes, he said, I'm totally coming. The inside of Tutt Library was buzzing with activity, filled with students who were dressed in all manner of absurd costumes. There was a boy wearing a Spider-Man costume and another dressed as a chicken. A couple had Reagan masks on. There was a woman in a lamé gown and a wrestling mask. Several people wore sombreros. Sitting down at one of the computers, Stillman decided to do some research and looked up Harlem Shake on Wikipedia. The videos, Wikipedia informed him, last 30 seconds and feature an excerpt from the song Harlem Shake. They begin with one person, often helmeted, dancing to the song alone for 15 seconds, surrounded by other people, not paying attention or unaware of the dancing individual. When the bass drops, the video switches to the entire crowd doing a crazy convulsive dance for the next 15 seconds. People wear a minimum of clothes or crazy outfits or costumes while wielding strange props. All right, declared a voice behind him. Let's do this. During the first 15 seconds, the library looked just as it would on any other Tuesday night. A handful of students leaned studiously over their books, and a lone figure danced to the beat. When those 15 seconds were over, the rest of them, the Spider-Men and the dinosaurs and the folks in sombreros, filed in, and the library exploded with noise. The next day, after the video had gone up on YouTube, Professor Stillman's students pointed him out to himself in the lower left-hand corner of the screen. There he was, still and unsmiling, clutching his copy of King Lear. That's you, said Henry, pointing to the screen. You killed it. Maybe he had killed it. But there was something ominous about the way he stood there, unmoving, as if he couldn't hear the booming bass. An oddly misplaced addition. It reminded him, mostly, of those paintings by Bruegel, the Danse Macabre paintings from Shakespeare's time. There is a ball, there are the young dancing, and in the corner of the painting, there is a single, fleshless face of a skeleton, a reminder of death. But then, just before the video ended, he began to shake, to seem to spring to life, to shuffle, to groove, to shimmy, and to shake. Look at you, dude, Henry shouted. Look at you. Do you think about like what you would like on your tombstone?
Actually, I don't even think about having a tombstone. I think burn my body and scatter it.
Is that right? You would want to be cremated?
Absolutely.
Why?
I don't want to be a burden to my children afterwards. They have to come someplace and have something. That's how I feel. I don't want anything on my tombstone. I'm dead. Move on. I was here.
Kathy Giuffre.
No, was here. No, I mean, I was here. Now I'm done.
Now I'm done. So that'll be on your tombstone.
No tombstone. Nothing.
Nothing.
Put it back to the earth.
I don't think I would go on a tombstone, though. Nothing. This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Giuffre.
And today we're discussing death in the digital age.
We are the robots.
It's a sobering thought to contemplate that right now someone, somewhere, is uploading a version of themselves doing the Harlem Shake to the internet. Increasingly today, it's difficult to think about what the outside of the digital world is like. And the question we're asking today is, how does that change the way that we think about death? How does that change our relationship to death? If we're out there in the digital world doing the Harlem Shake, Have we really died at all? We sat down with Stephen Pusday from Georgia State University. He's at work on a book about what he calls the digital logic of death. We wanted to talk to him about what death in the digital age means.
When I make the title The Digital Logic of Death, so I'm really talking about digital logic, the sense of digital thinking. So on the in the most basic level, when we think about the digital, we're thinking about zeros and ones, right? Off and on. You know, this extends to, you know, life and death in general, right? So we're already sort of thinking of things in a more concrete way, breaking down bits of information into their essence and then restructuring them in some way or another. So what happens when we begin to break down death and begin to think about it in new ways and structure it in new ways? How does this become, you know, scary for us, but then also how does this allow us to negotiate death in new ways? Just to think through the problem of mortality in new ways through digital technologies.
Like, what's one? I mean, you would. What is fascinating to me about your work is that it seems to me that there's something, and I think to a lot of people, that there's something fundamentally irreducible about death, right? Mm-hmm. That in a sense, death is death is death is death.
Right.
And yet you're saying that the digital age offers us new ways of thinking of
death.
How, like what?
Right. This is crazy to think about, but you know, I mean, you say death is death is death is death, unless you're playing a video game, right? And suddenly death doesn't mean it doesn't mean the end. It means a resetting, right? So suddenly death is a learning tool where we begin to explore where did I go wrong and how can I change this and how can I correct this? But, you know, that's of course not a way that we think about death in our regular lives, right? If I die, it's over for me. But in a game, it's simply a way for me to recognize what have I done wrong and how can I make improvements on this, right?
What do you think attracted you to the subject? Was there an aha moment that you were kind of like, you know, I'm really into video games. I'm also sort of into death. If I can put the two together, that would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, this starts from, you know, as a film studies person, you know, watching things like Ingmar Bergman films and seeing, you know, how have we explored death in the past and what kind of imagery have we used to represent death in specific ways. Mm-hmm. But then I think one of the real aha moments was playing a game like Infinity Ward's Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, right?
Right.
This is an incredibly popular series, in a lot of ways just, you know, a populist series that most people, when they play it, they're not thinking about, you know, existential issues like mortality. And yet the game is asking you to do so.
Be advised, 2-5, hostiles advancing parallel southwest-southwest of your position towards the crash site.
One of the characters that you play as is a soldier who is flying in a helicopter. The helicopter lands. They rescue their fellow soldiers. You make it back to the helicopter, and you're feeling like, you know, success. We've fought our way through and rescued our friends, and we're back on the helicopter. The helicopter takes off, and you're looking out the back of it, and suddenly there's this nuclear explosion that goes off.
We have a confirmed nuclear threat in the city. NEST teams are on site and attempting to disarm. I repeat. Everyone, hang on!
For a moment, it's kind of spectacular and thrilling, right? You're seeing this explosion going off, and you're thinking, I just made it out, right?
Right.
Which is, of course, one of the thrills that video games give us, is that being right on the edge of death and escaping, or films or television shows. But then as soon as you become complacent with the fact that you've made it, suddenly the helicopter starts spinning out of control as like the blast wave hits you. And the next thing you know, the helicopter's crashed and everything goes black, right?
Right.
And by the time you get out of the helicopter, you look around and the sky has gone dark. And there's ashes falling. And again, you're thinking like, as a game player, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to get out of this situation. And of course, your character does. He stands up. you take a step or two forward, and then the next thing you know, you fall to your knees, fall over, and everything goes dark. And suddenly there's this moment where you think, did I just die for real? Like, is my character actually dead? And it's this shocking moment as a game player. Like, you don't get to reset. You don't get to try again. And of course you have that sort of feeling. What did I do wrong? You know, how can I do this better? But of course, you don't get the chance to do it again. You are dead within the narrative. And so this was this moment where I thought, I've never felt a death like this before. You know, movies have made me sad about somebody else dying, but this was one of the first times where I felt like, you know, I just died, right? Something about me just experienced death in a very personal way that I've never seen before. So,
which had to do with the game.
And it had to do with the expectations that I brought to the table.
Right.
In terms of being able to, you know, reset and restart.
When it comes to video games, we really do have the expectation that we'll be able to reset and restart. But as Stephen Pusday was talking about this other experience in video games, a video game that presents us, as does life, with the impossibility of restarting and resetting. It made me think of an oddly conclusive experience my family and I had about a year ago with a video game that LEGO released called LEGO Universe.
You can be the hero and join your friends in an epic online adventure to save imagination.
And LEGO Universe was really a video game that was sort of aimed at, it was an MMO, so it was a multiplayer online game, right? And so everybody would play, and you'd have an avatar, and you'd sort of wander around this very benign LEGO space.
I know what these are.
You know, so I have two boys.
Eddie Hayward.
And?
Jimmy Hayward.
And they joined this game in September, and they fell in love with it. I mean, they were only allowed to play it on the weekends and then in very limited spurts, but that was really a thing that they loved. And they loved their identities mm-hmm. on there. They have mm-hmm. these extraordinary names.
The first one that I made was Geoma Jimmy.
Geoma Jimmy?
Yeah.
What does Geoma mean?
I don't know.
And what was the other guy's name?
I think it was Daz Fried Kahuna.
Say that again?
Daz Fried Kahuna.
What was the name of your guy, Eddie?
Classic Wayward Viking.
Classic Wayward Viking. They would go different places. Every place they went, they would get points. And with those points, they would do things like buy new clothes for their LEGO people, or they'd get pets.
I got a bunny, a kin, a dog, warthog, rhinoceros, robot dog. I tried 5 times to get a turtle.
It was like their life, but they could do all these kinds of things that they would. It took on a kind of reality. Anyway, we were on it for about a month and a half when LEGO releases word that LEGO Universe is ending.
Oh, my gosh.
There will be no more LEGO Universe. The game is just simply going to end on January 31st.
Why?
They didn't make enough money.
Well, no, they just decided that they could close for, like, not really an apparent reason. I was saying that I thought that they made enough money.
Yeah.
Like, there was a whole LEGO Universe Facebook that you could get on.
Right.
Yeah, or it was more like a LEGO Universe Twitter.
There was never any reason given. There was never any explanation given. And there was never any information that I could surface on it online that ever, you know, adequately explained why they were doing that.
Right.
And you know, when I told our kids, they of course confronted it with a certain degree of magical thinking of like, that can't possibly, the universe cannot, LEGO Universe can no more simply end than the universe could simply end.
I thought that it was a myth.
You thought, you didn't believe it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you believe it, Jimmy?
No.
What did you think?
I thought it was a myth also.
But it, you know, as we loomed up to the date, it took on this wildly stark bleakness, and our kids, it was just Eddie and Jimmy, they just got very sad. And eventually January 31st rolled around, and I have this memory of them. You know, we said that they could stay up and play. It was a Sunday night. You could stay up and you can play, we said, as long as you like. And eventually they did get tired, and they
and they did go to sleep. They weren't there for the actual ending of the universe, for which I was grateful. But the memory of them playing the video game, just with tears running down their faces, just crying and crying and crying, and just playing this game, it was the strangest conjunction of things.
You know, I remember that last night when we were playing Lego Universe, and we stayed up as late as we could. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to play as much Lego Universe. That was a really sad night, wasn't it?
Hmm. Yeah.
Why was it sad?
Well, we played on it for a while, and it was pretty good.
Yep.
What was really unique about this Lego Universe experience, what stayed with me, is the way in which it was an experience of finality. There was, on the one hand, when we heard the Lego Universe was ending, we felt like it couldn't happen. We felt like it was impossible, that the Lego Corporation would never do this and would mostly never do this to children. I mean, that was this combination of the two things. And the way that that Lego Universe really did end really was in many ways contrary to the logic of video games, right?
Right.
The idea that you could play a video game that would end and be gone conclusively and forever, and that that would be a video game that was linked and marketed to an audience who was 5 to 11 years old, mm-hmm. and then summarily just completely obliterated.
They closed the entire universe.
Even now, when I think about Lego Universe, even now when I think back to that night, you know, with little Eddie at the keyboard typing away and guiding himself through this orange and blue benign Lego landscape that right. was just about to be gone forever.
Right.
I still think, part of me thinks, that never happened.
Well, let me ask you a question. This is what I'm wondering about. That was the night of January 31st.
Yeah.
What was the day of February 1st like for them?
The first thing that they did is they came up and they said, see if it's still there. You right. know, this feeling of like, let's check and see if it really
just in case.
Did the world actually end? And so we did. And I have to say that I thought myself, my thinking was there must have been some kind of 11th hour reprieve from Lego.
Right.
Lego must have changed their mind.
Right.
We must have been imagining that.
Right.
And there was just this screen that said, Lego Universe has ended. We hope you had a good time. Goodbye.
Do you think it'll come back?
We're really hoping that it will. Mm-hmm. And I do think it could be like, you know, hockey, how it goes on strike for such a long time, and then all of a sudden you're like, bring it back, and then it's back.
You know what we should do when we get home?
What?
We should go to the Lego Universe site, just in case it's back.
Massive multiplayer online game. The actual universe is like real planets. There's no aliens, there's no massive. And Lego Universe is like there's giant dragons. Yeah!
Incredible weapons, like huge guns, like double blasters, incredible helmets, and like a cape, and nobody has a cape. Sometimes there are serious things like 500 imagination or 2,000 coins.
You have to fight Frag John, Skeleton of Fire, and he is so hard, like he has armies of little skeletons. Skeleton horses, skeletons.
It was really fun.
This is Off Topic. Stay with us. I'm Steve Hayward. You're listening to Off Topic. And my guest today is Stephen Pusday of Georgia State University. He's at work on a book having to do with death in the digital age.
Has death changed in video games over the last 20 years, let's say?
Absolutely. I mean, if we go back to a game like, say, Pac-Man or Frogger, right?
Right?
these games couldn't end in any way other than death, right? You put in your quarter, and the whole thing was designed to lead towards death, right? You put in your quarter, and you keep playing for as long as possible, and the whole goal is avoid, so you're playing Pac-Man, avoid these ghosts for as long as possible. But of course, eventually, these ghosts are going to catch you, right? Mm-hmm. And suddenly you're going to see Pac-Man's body kind of implode, and, you know, death has reached you, and it's game over, right? Today, that's not the case. Modern games are kind of designed where there is no real game over. Mm-hmm. You die, but you have infinite lives, and really you're playing it to the completion of a narrative rather than playing it only towards the death of the on-screen character. So absolutely there's been this shift in terms of what role death plays in terms of the closure of the game.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to sort of think about, you bring up Frogger, Pac-Man, I think of playing Donkey Kong, mm-hmm. and talk about something that would remind you of the finite quality, not only of one's existence, mm-hmm. because it was all about the inevitability of death,
right.
also about all kinds of other material, like the inevitability of running out of money.
Right, exactly. It's interesting how these economic factors have shifted the way we think about death in games, right?
Right.
On the one hand, it was, if you want to survive and, you know, if you want to continue playing, feed me more money.
I watch them in my arcades. They stand like laboratory rats hitting the feeder bar to get a food pellet. But as long as they keep pumping in the quarters, who gives a shit, right?
Today, because the purchase is done up front, now we can kind of change and shift the where death comes into play. And we have this expectation that, we should be able to continue moving forward past the on-screen death of the character.
Is it essentially optimistic then? Like is that what death in the digital age is? It's like, you know, don't worry because it's a video game. I mean, that's a reduction, but...
Yeah, I think a more sort of complicated view on this is that the process that's really going on here, Freud, can I talk about Freud here?
You're absolutely, okay. It is, we are, the off-topic listening audience is completely okay with
okay,
Freud.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. So
don't get crazy or anything.
I won't get too crazy.
Don't get all nutty when you're talking about Freud.
Right.
But yeah, a little bit of Freud is okay.
I won't get too crazy here. When we talk about the death drive, Freud's concept of the death drive, usually that conversation gets couched
so Freud's idea of the death drive is that, so he says we have two instincts, not one.
Mm-hmm.
It comes to this realization right at the end of his life, post First World War.
Right.
Where he says, this all this destructiveness, there must be something else animating it.
Right.
There's the life force.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this other thing. What is it?
There's Eros, the sexual drive, and there's Thanatos, the death drive, right? Or at least what would come to be known as Thanatos after Freud. So in 1920, when Freud writes Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he begins to develop this notion of the death drive, right?
Right.
The way that we talk about the death drive in kind of contemporary scholarship, in many contemporary readings of the death drive, they focus on destruction, right? Our impulse to destroy. So not only the world around us, but ourselves as well, right?
Yeah, you're standing at the edge of a building. Maybe I should jump.
Exactly.
That feeling, it's this irrational desire for annihilation.
Exactly. I think that that's absolutely an aspect of the death drive, and it's one that I think Freud was most comfortable with because it's what he continued to develop later on. But in the very first development of the death drive, which is in his text Beyond the Pleasure Principle, Freud had a different kind of sense of the death drive, which was a sense that, and to use a phrase that he wrote, that the aim of all life is death,
mm-hmm.
that life itself is this series of tensions, right? Everything about life creates tensions. And the only way to relieve those tensions is to go back to the place that we began, which is non-existence, right? So first we didn't exist, then we came into existence and became, involved in all of these tensions. And then in order to relieve these tensions, the only way to do it is to die, right?
Right.
So in other words, that all organisms are driven to return to their previous state, that previous state, of course, being non-existence, right? One of the things that Freud mentioned then in talking about this desire to return to a previous state was that all human endeavor then is a negotiation towards death, what he called creating the path to death, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of our decisions that we're making are essentially decisions in order to get to death the best way, right? To not die too early, or in order to relieve these tensions the best way possible,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, again, everything that we do is creating our own personal path to death, right? When we turn back to digital games then, or to video games, what we see is a kind of virtual version of this process, right? Where every time I die and the game says, that's not the right death for this character, right? You've got this character and he's got a goal, right? To save somebody or to accomplish some kind of something. If midway through the game he gets randomly shot, or he falls off a cliff, or he gets blown up, right? This does not relieve tensions. In fact, this only builds tensions, right? It makes us even more anxious. And so by rewinding and by reanimating, what we're actually doing is creating a digital path to death, right? We're finding out which deaths are wrong so that we can get to the right death. And so it's shocking how many modern game narratives end with the character's narrative death, right? They die constantly throughout the game, and every time they do, they come back, only for us to get to the end and have them be killed for real, right?
Right.
But usually in a way that's narratively satisfying, right? And so what we've been doing throughout the entire game is creating a digital path to death, finding our way through and past all of these wrong deaths in order to get to the right one.
Right.
The one that is satisfying and that relieves tensions rather than builds upon them.
Right. It's the idea that the moment when you die is the right ending to your story.
Exactly.
Did you ever play that game that was like, how would you like to die?
No, I've never even heard of this game.
Well, it's a game like when you say like...
There's a difference between Canada and Arkansas. You played How Would You Like to Die? We played Spin the Bottle, man. It was a different culture.
Yeah, we played how Would You Like to Die? And I guess you played how Might We Survive? You know, a little bit like when you first become conscious of being a mortal being, like,
right.
How would you like to go? You know, I mean, one of the things about... when I think about my own family and death, it was that there was never like a moment when we weren't all extraordinarily conscious, mostly because of my grandfather, who would sit at the head of the table every day or every Sunday when we would have dinner, lunch. And he would always make some pronouncement about things that I was supposed to do when he died. And he would say,
you particularly,
I was supposed to do, he'd say, Stephen, he would say, when I go, I would like you to spit on my sister Mary at my funeral. Okay, so video games take us into that moment when we experience finality in a curiously unfinal way, in a curiously vicarious way. But isn't that exactly the kind of thing that poets have been doing for hundreds of years? Kathy Giuffre sat down with poet Jane Hilberry to talk about the poetic approach to death.
Jane Hilberry, talking with us, who is the author of Body Painting, a book of poems, and another book, This Awkward Art, which is a book of poems that she wrote with her father, Conrad Hilberry. So, Jane, poets write about death all the time. Why is that something that poets particularly explore?
Yeah, that's interesting, and I wonder if poets do it more than other artists do, probably. And probably poets do it more than fiction writers do, too. It may be because part of what poetry does is to give you sort of a heightened sense of experience. And thinking about death does heighten the experience of being alive. Right. But also I think that death is like the great unknown. Nobody can come back and tell us about it. So the only way that we have to understand it is through imagination.
Right. Can you give us one of these poems, an example of a poet trying to do this thing, trying to imagine or maybe even psychologically prepare for something that is going to be beyond our experience?
Yeah, I would really like to read a poem by Brian Turner. So Brian Turner is a veteran. He was an infantry team leader for a year in the Iraq War. He writes very, very powerfully about death and about the experience of being in combat. And I think that what happens in this poem, it's called Here, Bullet, which is also the name of his collection of poems, that what it's doing is really saying, okay, death, come and get me. Here, Bullet, if a body is what you want, then here is bone and gristle and flesh. Here is the clavicle snapped wish, the aorta's opened valves, the leap thought makes at the synaptic gap. Here is the adrenaline rush you crave, that inexorable flight, that insane puncture into heat and blood. And I dare you to finish what you started. Because here, Bullet, here is where I complete the word you bring hissing through the air. Here is where I moan the barrel's cold esophagus, triggering my tongue's explosives for the rifling I have inside of me. Each twist of the round spun deeper, because here, Bullet, is where the world ends every time.
Mm-hmm. It's such an immediate experience of death, so much inside his own body.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when you're in that situation where people are in such close contact with death and are so vulnerable, that you really need psychologically to defend yourself against this thing that honestly could happen at any moment.
So I want to contrast that with a different poem you brought, with Emily Dickinson, because with Turner we really have someone who's in a very violent situation where death is very, very immediate and where it's probably happening all around him. Whereas Emily Dickinson, we have someone whose life is much quieter, much more secluded, and where the presence of death isn't so immediate. And yet Emily Dickinson also took this first-person imagination of death and put it down on paper.
Right, and she's trying to get as close as possible to the moment of death. She's taking us through this experience right up to the moment when I died. All right, I'll read this one. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breaths were gathering firm for that last onset when the king be witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portions of me be assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think that's amazing about it is that she has imaginatively put herself in this place where she cannot have in actuality been.
Been, uh-huh, right.
Does poetry help you think about your own mortality?
I think poetry has helped me think about mortality, and I think the reason I started writing poetry was because I had a sister who died when I was very young. I was 3 years old. My dad was a poet, through him, I was given tools to deal with this experience. So for me, I started writing about my sister's death.
Right.
And what that allowed me to do was to make the death real. I think poetry can be incredibly transformative. I mean, that's one of my most fundamental beliefs about poetry is that, you know, here's this horrible thing that happened. There's no other way to say it. It was a horrible thing. But if you can turn it into poetry, it somehow, maybe again, it gives you some purchase on the experience. It gives you a little bit of, not control, but it can make you, you can make something out of it. You can shape it in some way mm-hmm. so that you're not just totally at its mercy. And then also you can make something that's beautiful out of it. And so it's been transformed in some way.
You have one of your poems here, your own poems.
I have a poem about my mother's death, just a little short poem, Driving. About to step out of the sleeve of her body, my mother wants to keep all of her clothes. She thinks she'll wear that fuchsia shirt again. She says she wants to start driving. In truth, she never liked to drive, pushing the wheel one way or the other in tiny increments. The speeds on the highway scared her.
Thank you, Jane. Jane Hilberry, who is the author of Body Painting, a book of poems. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Kathy.
You're listening to Off Topic, and I'm Steve Hayward. That was poet Jane Hilberry talking about the way that poets have approached the theme of death in their work. We're going to return to our conversation with scholar Stephen Pustay. He's working on a book project having to do specifically with death in the digital age.
One of the things that I'm struck by is the durability of the digital.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of things like people's Facebook, you know, profiles.
Right.
I was recently doing an event where I was inviting people to come to this reading that we were having. And you know how Facebook has that function where it says people to invite. And a number of the people, not a ton of them, of course, but you know, a few of the people who Facebook thought I should be inviting to the event were dead.
Mm-hmm.
And yet their profile popped up. I went to their profile. The profile is still existent in a way that they aren't. And I wonder if you see that durability of the digital, the way in which it inadvertently almost memorializes people. Is that an aspect of the death in the digital age?
Absolutely. You know, in the same way that I think that in video games we're creating a sense of virtual identity, like a second identity, the same is happening in online spaces. So, of course, you know, we're all sort of aware of this split between who we are as people and how we represent ourselves on something like a social network like Facebook.
Right.
So we're literally creating these kind of second virtual identities. But the scary part is that these second virtual identities are not subject to death, right? So when someone passes away in real life, suddenly you have this second identity that still is existing and is still floating around in the internet. And it's a little scary for us. And it can become, on the one hand, it can become difficult to deal with, but on the other hand, it's a piece of them that's still there. And so it's a way for us to remember somebody. So that's where this kind of, you know, memorializing comes into play. This is where curating your Facebook page and all of these things, why privacy settings become so important, right?
Right.
It's this way to define who you are online in a way that will be acceptable to you if you're no longer around to defend it. Right?
Right. So that's a good way of thinking about your Facebook page as if it's your tombstone.
Right, exactly. It's a virtual tombstone that has pictures and videos and whatever, and you want them to be the right pictures, and you want the quote on your face or on your Facebook tombstone to be a positive one, right?
Yeah. So then, because people always say that, what would you want on your tombstone?
Mm-hmm.
You really need to be asking yourself that question every minute of every day.
Absolutely, right?
Every time you update your Facebook status or your Twitter feed or your LinkedIn profile, that is your tombstone.
Right. Absolutely.
I think that's a really liberating thought.
Sure. I mean, it's liberating or terrifying, depending on the perspective that you want to look
at. But how is it terrifying?
I mean, I just from my own personal perspective, it's one of the, I'm very private online. You know, I tend to, rather than building up a list of thousands of friends, I like to purge them as much as possible, you know, reduce it to people who I actually know and care about, right? Perhaps because maybe when I'm gone, I want those people to be the people who remember me. I don't want random strangers thinking or you know, long lost acquaintances to think that they know who I was when I was alive.
So do you call it, you know, like regularly? Do you pick up people and you say like, that person is dead to me and unfriendly?
Yeah, well, there's another way of looking at it too. But yeah, I absolutely, you know, I have rules about it, you know. There was one point where I felt like my friend list got way too big, right? So I made a rule. If I haven't talked to you at least twice in the past year, then there's no reason for me to be friends with you on Facebook, right?
And I'll tell you something that I've never done on Facebook. And I wonder if you have ever done this. Have you ever unfriended a dead person on Facebook?
I'm fortunate enough not to have any friends on Facebook who have passed away. Yeah, but I mean, that would be a really interesting question, you know.
Well, thank you.
Is unfriending a person who's passed away, is blocking their email, is it somehow denying their existence, right? Are we somehow letting them go into the ether and forgetting about them, right? And what does that do to their memory, right? Which is why we memorialize and why we do these things. But at the same time, isn't that a part of the process of grieving, right? Aren't we encouraged to let go at some point? So at what point does the permanence of the digital identity become something that holds us back? You know, holds us back from moving on? And, you know, when does it make death too present, right? I certainly think that death should be something that we are conscious of and something, it should be a present in our lives. But, you know, can it be too present?
Yeah.
And perhaps that's what happens, you know.
Do you have an idea? Do you think about what you would like your tombstone to say? Steve
Pusday. It didn't bum people out too much, you know, didn't.
Or maybe there would be like a Steve Pusday didn't bum people out too much, despite the fact that he wrote about death in the digital age.
Right, exactly.
You know, or maybe Steve Pusday, cheerful guy, in spite of
in
all
spite,
the death.
Yeah. That's what I'm hoping. I'm just hoping that I can, you know, encourage people to think about these issues, but in a way that doesn't make them go home and cry, you know.
Yeah.
That's my goal, is to find a way to make this a part of the public discourse without, you know, causing a panic.
All right. Well, thanks for being here with us. My guest again, once again, is Steve Pusday. His book is called The Digital Logic of Death. And thanks so much for being here. It's a fascinating discussion, fascinating subject. And I think you're absolutely right that needs to be in the public discourse. Hope you'll come back again.
Oh, cool. Absolutely. That would be great.
Talk thank more you. Death. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
You think your youth a permanent truth, but here is a tear for your heart. Having forgotten how to cry, I die.
This is Off Topic.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
What I'm thinking about is this, is that we all live in this world. Maybe it won't end. And I, of course, I'm naturally thinking, because I have teenage boys, about zombies. Mm-hmm. And isn't that what zombies are? Is this the dead don't die. They're still here some way. That none of this is going to be forever, and none of this is going to be real. That somehow, in some, you know, partial way, we'll have our reprieve. we're not going to have to see the world end. And as a sociologist, I wonder, is that because we see the world around us and these... And it does seem like an apocalypse is happening. It does seem like things like global warming and North Korean nuclear missiles and the environment being completely destroyed, that maybe the world is, and population exploding and people don't, and drug-resistant diseases, it can get you at any moment, that a lot of this is a cultural way of dealing with this terrible fear that... that we don't want to face. Not only is Lego universe ending, our universe is ending.
Yeah, it's not only do we live in an 11th hour world, as you say, we've always lived in that 11th hour world. It's always been not us.
Right.
It's always been in death is what happens to other people.
Right, because death is what happens to other people.
Yeah. And I think that that's the human condition. You know, it's oddly the opposite of video games, except for Lego Universe, which tells the truth about the human condition that Lego Universe never meant to tell. Off Topic is produced at the Tim Gill Center for Public Media in Colorado Springs.
We're a production of KRCC and the Colorado College, produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell.
I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffre. Thanks for joining us.
And until next week, stay off topic.
And it's pretty fun. It's, like, filled with secrets.
So I never... this guy is literally covered with elbows.